Excellent. So, David, do you want to get us started?
Sure. Yeah, I'm the topic today is described in the notice is induction and deduction. These are two broad categories of logical inferences, fundamental distinction in logic. It goes back, I think, at least to Aristotle. And many people are familiar with this. Some people have occasionally run into people say, okay, remind me which is which. So I'm going to start by explaining the distinction briefly, and then on to my main interest, which is how does this distinction, excuse me, how does the distinction apply to objectivism? So let me start with induction and deduction. Here are two examples. For deduction, classic example, all men are mortal. Socrates was a man, therefore Socrates was mortal. Okay, that's deductive, and I'll explain why in a moment. Second example of induction. Two flowers of the same cultivar were planted in adjacent plots. The first one was fertilized with Miracle-Gro, and it flourished. The second one was not, and it didn't. So, therefore, Miracle-Gro causes plant growth. Now, the operative distinction here is the measure of deductive arguments is validity. A deductive argument is either valid or invalid. It's all or nothing. Validity means that the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises. You can't accept premises and deny the conclusion without contradiction. In the Socrates example, if you accept the premises that all men are mortal and Socrates was a man, but say, oh, but wait a minute, Socrates was immortal. You can't, that's a contradiction because it contradicts the major premise that all men are mortal. So, by contrast, if the argument were cast as some men are mortal, Socrates was a man, therefore Socrates was mortal, that would not be valid. That would be invalid because it doesn't follow. You can coherently, without contradiction, deny the conclusion, and it doesn't contradict the premises because the premise says only that some men are mortal. Okay, for induction, the standard is not validity, but strength. And strength means the degree of support that the premises give to the conclusion. And that degree of strength can often be increased by providing more evidence. For example, with the plant example, you could vary some other factors, increase the sample size, look at the lighting conditions, were they really identical, and so on and so forth. So, another angle on this is that in deductive arguments, the conclusions, in a sense, just spell out what is already contained in the premises. The conclusion follows regardless of any other information. It is not sensitive to a wider context. Now, I'm going to, epistemologically, I'm going to say, yeah, well, the major premise has to be supported by something, typically induction. So there is a wider context, but we may come back to that. But the point is, just taking the argument as it as stated, it is, in a sense, acontextual. Whereas inductive conclusions, go beyond what is stated in the premises. They are what logicians call ampliative. They amplify the claim that's being supported by the premises. For example, in our the example about plants, the premises were all about the particular plants that were tested in this agricultural experiment. But the conclusion is about all plants. So there's a what some people have called a logical leap here from the premises to the conclusion. There's still some gap between premises and conclusions. And as a result, inductive arguments are sensitive to context. I mean, suppose the first plot in our flower example was in sunlight, the second one in shade. Well, we could strengthen the argument by keeping the lighting constant, as I said, or varying other factors. So that's a basic distinction. Now, it's sometimes said that deduction applies a general statement, like all men are mortal, to a particular case, like Socrates, whereas induction moves in the opposite direction from particular to general, from these cultivars in these plants to all plants. There's a grain of truth in this, which I'll come back to, but it is not strictly correct in a logical sense. There are deductive arguments that do not involve a movement from general to particular. For example, here's an example from a Sherlock Holmes story. If robbery had been the motive for the crime, the victim's wallet would not be full of cash, but the wallet was full of cash, so robbery was not the motive. That has the form if P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P. It's an inference form known as modus tollens. And that's a deductive argument. Everything I said about the Socrates example is true of this. You can't accept the premises and deny the conclusion without contradiction. And in the same way, not all inductive arguments move from particular to general. Argument by analogy, for example, as normally formulated, moves from one set of particulars to an analogous set of particular or set of particulars. And so it doesn't move from particular to general. So I just want to make that point because this is such a common view. All right, so that's induction and deduction, a quick lesson in logic. Now I want to get on to the main topic, which is how does that distinction apply to the objectivist ethics? I'm going to give you a really whirlwind tour, a logical tour of the objectivist ethics, showing how inductive and deductive inferences combine in philosophical reasoning. The particular point in the objectivist ethics I'm going to focus on is the principle that rationality is a virtue. Okay, now rationality is only one ethical principle I could use as an illustration, and ethics is only one branch of our philosophy to which the pattern applies. The pattern is quite pervasive. And in that respect, I want to mention that I'm drawing partly on a work that William Thomas and that I produced called The Logical Structure of Objectivism. It is on our website. It is known to its friends as LSO, and we have not published it for various reasons, but it's published on our website, and it's a great teaching tool. So anyway, what is the evidence for rationality? I'm going to review it in three stages. I told you this is going to be a whirlwind tour. Stage one, life is the basis of value. At the very foundation of the objectivist ethics is the principle that for any organism, the life of the organism is the ultimate value that determines what other things are values or disvalues for it. And that principle is based on induction. The concept, we start with the concept of value, that something that you act to gain and or keep. Well, that means that we're talking about purpose of action. Where do we find purpose of action in nature, in the world? Only in all living things, but only in living things. When we act as individuals in our human lives, we're acting for something that makes a difference to us, that we conceive of as, you know, we're aware of as making a difference. But even non-conscious things like simple organisms or plants nevertheless are alive, and they can initiate goal-directed action, unlike a rock or a mountain, and that all but only living organisms face the alternative of existing or not, living or dying, which is then which you can't get more fundamental in terms of making a difference. So we have the inductive generalization drawn on a vast amount of knowledge and observations about the biological world that an organism's life is conditional. It depends on the organism's action to acquire and maintain the conditions of its own existence. So there's a lot more to this. I'm taking a lot of shortcuts here in the argument, and I'm skip the among the steps I'm skipping, some would, you know, could easily be cast as deductive. But the point is, the whole objectivist ethics, the whole foundation of life as the ultimate value, is based essentially on inductive observation of living things. Okay, so that was point one. Point two, stage one. Stage two, every type of organism has its own specific needs that it has to meet if it's going to maintain itself, and it has specific capacities for self-generated action to meet those needs. So obviously, what a jellyfish has to do to maintain its existence in the ocean is quite different from what a lion on the African savannah has to do to maintain its existence, and so on across the entire range of biological things. Trees have to get chlorophyll, they have to have means of acquiring the chlorophyll they need, as well as water and other things. We could multiply examples in more or less indefinitely. The point is that for each species, there is a distinctive set of needs it has to meet and capacities that it can exercise to meet those needs. And identifying those needs and capacities is inductive. I mean, think of ethology in the life sciences. Ethologists like Conrad Lorenz and Carl von Frisch wanted to understand animal behavior, not in terms of the proximate causes, such as reflex or conditioning, but rather in terms of the teleological function described and explained the animal's behavior in its natural environment. Their goal was to understand the mode of life of each species, its particular way of surviving in its particular environment, given its particular needs and capacities. Well, the same is true of human beings. I think Rand saw ethics as a kind of human ethology. Her concept of man's life qua man is really an ethological concept of man's mode of living. So we identify human needs and capacities the same way we do for other species, by observing human nature and actions and drawing, you know, mostly inductive generalizations. It's, of course, much more complicated because our needs are vastly more extensive and our capacities vastly more extensive than for other species that we know of. But the fact is, the general principle of identifying what an organism needs and what capacities it has to meet those needs applies to human beings just as it does to any other species. And we identify that in the same way, by observing human nature and drawing inductive generalizations. So, by the way, despite what I said earlier, these generalizations typically do move from the particular to the general, these inductive generalizations. That's actually part of the nature of an inductive generalization. That's only one type of induction, but it's a very important part. So that's a large grain of truth that I referred to earlier. So with human beings, though, let's move to the human case. The inductive evidence comes from a huge, huge variety of sources, not just from biology and medicine about our physical needs for food, air, water, and so forth, but across the range of our psychological needs. We learn about those needs and capacities from introspection as well as psychology. We learn about them from history, how human beings have acted and flourished or failed to flourish in the past, from economics, which tells us about how the trade in the social realm, one aspect of the social realm, how that works, political science, I could go on, but you get the point. All of this has to come back to observations. And the conclusions we can draw from those observations. So it remains largely inductive. Once we have a certain amount of inductive conclusions that we're confident of, there are things we can deduce from those broader principles. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples in a moment. But the point is, identifying needs and capacities is basically an inductive procedure. And this is not as clear as it might have been in Ayn Rand's own writings. She lays out a set of conclusions in the Objectivist Ethics, and those conclusions fit together, you know, in a way that some people can say, well, it's all deductive. It's not. One of the things that Will Thomas and I have tried to do in the Logical Structure book is to break apart some of those conclusions and ask, you know, what's the real basis, using a diagramming technique, but also with a lot of attention to the inductive versus deductive stages of each component argument. All right, so much for needs and capacities. Now let's get to the third point, reason and rationality. Well, reason is an essential capacity that we have. So, and all the fields I mentioned before support that principle, as do many other features of human life. I mean, look at the role of law, of language, of science, technology. All of those are reflections of a rational capacity, and possible only to creatures that have such a capacity. So that is that's a conclusion that we draw in terms of capacities. We could also say that there are many, many needs that humans have. I said before that they're much more extensive and complicated than typical needs of even animals, let alone plants. One interesting thing is that because our reason is such an important core capacity, it has its own needs to function properly. So we have some of our needs are not direct needs for physical survival, but for spiritual survival, for maintaining our ability to think and guide our actions by reason. One of them is a need for self-esteem. We can talk about that later, but because we're self-conscious, we need a sense of ourselves and the confidence that our minds do work and that our lives are worthy of support. So that's a kind of indirect need, but no less important than the direct physical needs of air, water, food, and so forth. Okay, so what about rationality? Here, we have to take account of free will. You can establish that reason is an important human capacity simply by the kinds of ethological investigation of the human mode of life. But rationality is, reason doesn't operate automatically. And as far as we know, only humans have this capacity of choosing or not choosing to exercise that capacity. We have to act by choice. So that's what makes rationality a virtue. Not simply a value, but a virtue and a moral virtue, because the moral realm deals with the scope of choice. And again, that's distinctive to human beings. So you could formulate this actually as a deductive inference. Exercising reason is required for life. Exercising reason, i.e. rationality, is voluntary. Voluntary actions required for life are moral virtues. So rationality is a moral virtue. Any of the points I've made so far could be elaborated much, much fuller, and I hope we will have a chance to do that in the question period. But I want to end with two broader points. First, about deduction. Most of what I've summarized at each stage of the derivation, stages 1, 2, and 3, focused on inductive evidence. And that's in part because objectivism has often been mischaracterized as a rationalist system of pure deduction, like a mathematical proof, or like, those of you who know the history of philosophy, Spinoza's ethics, which modeled on Euclid's geometry as a purely deductive system. And that's not true. That objectivism is empiricist, and it is every conclusion has to be supported at some level by inductive evidence as well as deductive derivation. I'll come to that in a minute. I'll come to it now. Deduction, however, does have a really important role. And for example, just to give one example, we could cast the entire summary I've presented in terms of a single syllogism. For any organism, the life of the organism is the ultimate value that determines whether other things are values or disvalues for it. Human beings are living organisms, so the life of a human is the ultimate value, etc. What this summarizes a vast amount of evidence, which I've summarized only in broad essence. Well, it does have a value, this deductive argument, because it shows, it integrates everything. And it shows us in particular that the objectivist ethic is biocentric. It is deeply grounded in the nature of life across all its forms. It is, the ethics is not a self-contained body of knowledge as many philosophers treat it. It is a body of knowledge and practical and guidance knowledge as well as theoretical knowledge that has a profound, deep naturalist basis in the world. And that's one of the important functions of deduction. It helps us unite and keep integrated our knowledge across wide spheres of knowledge. And finally, I want to say about induction, second point. Induction, as I mentioned earlier, it's ampliative. Inductive inferences are typically open to further evidence. And the point here is that, the point I want to make now is that we strengthen our conclusion not just by acquiring more confirming cases, for example, more plants that grow well with Miracle-Gro, but also, and even more importantly, by actively looking for disconfirming cases to test the strength of the conclusion. The harder we look for disconfirming cases, the better off we are in, the more confident we can be in the conclusion that we've drawn from the positive cases. And this is especially important in philosophy because we don't have many of the methods of science, of measurement, experimentation, and so forth, that scientists can use to form additional hypotheses, test additional possible causal factors, and so forth. We have to go by basically qualitative reasoning. And so it's all the more important we can put together a very strong case. I think the objectivist case is super strong. That's why I believe it. But we should always be open to finding and considering cases like that. So let me just end by putting this as a kind of challenge to you and as a homework assignment, but we can start by, I can say it's due right now. What challenges could be mounted to the principle that rationality is a virtue? What exceptions, what things would such a principle have to deal with to be fully verified and for us to be totally confident of in order to strengthen all the inductive evidence that I've provided? So, okay, I'll stop there. I know I've been moving really, really fast through a huge landscape, but I hope this clarified some things. And let's go to questions.
Great. Thank you, David. I just want to thank those of you, quite a few of you, who have shared this room and encourage others to use the little share button down below, share it on Clubhouse. Share it on your social media. So I appreciate that. I wanted to recognize that we have two other senior scholars in the room, both Professor Richard Salzman as well as Professor Jason Hill on their travels. And also thank my co-host Scott, and of course our friend Roger. And yes, so as David mentioned, please raise your hand. We'll bring you up on stage. And then David, also maybe if you wanted to introduce Debbie and Will, and invite them to offer any additions or reflections on your remarks.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. Debbie Hutchins is my co-author for the logic text, The Art of Reasoning, which we a year and a half ago or so produced the fifth edition of that. And so, you know, if you want to know more about induction and deduction, you can check the book out or listen to Debbie, who's the real expert on deductive logic. And Will Thomas is my co-author for the Logical Structure book. And so we spent many, many hours, days, weeks producing that and thinking through all the arguments and paying special attention to the inductive versus the deductive elements. So I'm delighted that you're both here, and please jump in with any comments.
Yeah, you just would need to unmute yourself if you're muted. But otherwise, maybe I'll go to Scott. Oh, go ahead, Debbie.
Yes, I wanted to say, one, I enjoyed the summary today. The issue, I think a couple of very strong things are in support of David's comments he made. One, I just got to say on the record, I love that you listed that you consider rationality a moral virtue. Because it introduces the notion of having a responsibility to be rational, and I like that. But the idea of ethics being based on the nature of the thing seems obvious, at least from a certain sort of philosophical view. I know in I've worked at schools where we took curriculum very seriously at a previous job I had. All students were required to take four courses of philosophy, regardless of major. And they were designed in a very specific way, and we had to defend our contention that you had to take the sophomore course, Philosophy of Human Nature, before as a prerequisite for ethics. And part of our justification we came up with, to know the correct behavior or the best life for a human being, you have to have thought about the nature of the human being, of the human person. Because the ethics can't be disconnected from that. And I think in the broader sense, one thing David and I have in common that isn't as common in philosophy as it used to be, although since I'm assuming the majority of people in this meeting are probably objectivist, this is going to apply to you whether you've thought about it this way or not. David and I are both metaphysical realists. And if you're a metaphysical realist, metaphysics questions about the natures of things are prior to, or what should I say, foundational to how they should behave, ethics. So if you're a metaphysical realist, if you believe there are certain brute facts of the universe, then any creature, any rational creature should be able to see that you're going to have to deal with those facts.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie. And I'm glad for the reminder that the broad contours of the objectivist ethics, basing the ethics on a prior analysis of human nature, is something that is common also in the Aristotelian tradition. They have different maybe conclusions about aspects of human nature and aspects of ethics, but that broad issue of dependence is something that has a history in philosophy, has So thanks for that.
Scott, and I'm going to bring Richard up on stage.
Yeah, thank you. Great conversation. I'm just curious about kind of intuition, you know, or even Rand was kind of against instinct, but there's just sometimes a sense before we're able to process everything that's going on, but we're making, you know, like lightning fast decisions just based on what we do know, even if we can't put it into words.
An example of the question I asked right at the end, what apparent counterexamples to rationality as a virtue or a comprehensive, you know, virtue that should dictate every choice, every conclusion we reach, every choice we make in life. One of the tasks for an objectivist philosophy, people in philosophy and psychology, is to explain how the many forms in which reason works, and whether or not, for example, what you say describe as intuition is a form of rational integration, but subconscious, so not as deliberate as a conscious logical derivation, or whether it's something else altogether, emotion driven. Which leads to the wider question, what about emotions as a guide to action? That's another question that would have to be addressed. Objectivists do, but Rand does, but it's still, that's one of the arguments that you run into all the time in talking about rationality. Instinct is another really interesting one, because the question is whether it involves any inborn innate knowledge, or whether it's simply a built-in mechanism of action at the perceptual level. So I'm just raising these. I'm not going to address them because that would be a long, pretty long thing. But some of these are worthy of their own clubhouse session or more. But those are great examples to think about. When you're considering the case for rationality as a virtue.
Richard?
Yes, thank you. This is great, David, and great to hear from Debbie. I think evolutionary biology, which is has become so prominent of late, last decade or so, is another alternative here. I don't endorse it, but you've heard this, I think, David, the idea that whatever works over time must be right, must be good, must be true. If it has a survival, this is somewhat close to objectivism, if it has a survival value for human beings. So, you know, they try to describe a cooperation among humans as a virtue. And why is it a virtue? Not because we chose it rationally, but because that just seems to have worked over time. If we don't cooperate, we kill each other off. If we do, we survive. That kind of thing you've probably heard. So I just throw that out there. But my real question was, I'm really intrigued by the induction side of what you're talking about, and I'm reminded of how sometimes one of the ways Aristotle's ethics is critiqued is that it only looked out at Athenians or the Greeks and found what were presumed to be good traits or good men. And you could say he induced and said, then now these are the virtues. And it wasn't a bad result, but it wasn't a fundamental argument. And the reason I think of that is the objectivist ethics draws somewhat on Aristotle, but I also think it from the standpoint of, does this make it difficult, David, to induce today? Meaning, we don't have Greek citizens today, I don't think, of the kind of virtue, of the high virtue we see. So is it a challenge to today's whoever, students, professors, to get them to induce the kind of virtues we highlight, because they can't see them, or they can't see them consistently because, and I'm just stipulating, I don't know if this is true or not, because the constellation of virtues and vices out there today are such a mixed grab bag of things. And I'll just leave it as this. The analogy to me is when I try to explain to people what is good or bad in the mixed economy, right? And to get them to see, well, the bad part is the status part and the good part is the capitalist part. So don't blame crises on the capitalist part. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to get them to disentangle this mix. And I'm just wondering whether you think that's also true in getting them to try to disentangle virtue from vice in today's context. I hope that's not too convoluted.
No, and this is why I think history is a really important source of information, and why I think it's so important. I think, as I recall, Rand was a history major in her college years in St. Petersburg. And to see how, you know, how people lived best, how and what societies flourished. So that's one thing. I think people should, this is the grain of truth, kind of a small one in the circumstances, but the grain of truth in multiculturalism, that the more cultures you know about, the more inductive evidence you have to draw from. And so I'm all in favor of that, and along with history. But the problem I have with one of the other examples you mentioned is, well, let me just go back. Students today have conceptual problems that anyone in teaching, you know, has noticed. And actually thinking through the evidence about human nature and values. It's, you know, you can't do this in a 30-second TikTok video. You've got to you have to read, observe, think, go to school. And there's such a large amount of information there. Brand once said something to the effect that, you know, the humanities, and I would add the social sciences, are almost all about human life. That's, you know, over half a normal curriculum. So this is not easy. And, you know, I think having a philosophy like objectivism that points us in such good directions is an enormous set of shoulders to stand on, to use Newton's analogy. But it takes work. And I don't think there are any real shortcuts. But let me just say about the evolutionary psychology. I've read a lot, although I'm not an expert. And my problem with it is that, as you put it well, it's the idea that we adopt modes of life not because we chose them, but because they were genetically selected by success or failure. That still uses life as a basic standard, but it also relies on determinism. It says that we, take one of the typical examples, why do men tend to be more promiscuous than women, at least in feelings? Well, because the explanation being they can generate more babies, multiply their genes faster than a woman can who has to bear the fetus, and during the birth of the child needs help and support. Well, there may be something to that, but we have free will and we can question all of these things. And what, you know, some people, including some men, don't have children. They don't care about their genes. Some people, you know, are thoughtful enough to avoid shortcuts like predation. Most of the prehistoric modes of human survival involved a lot of warfare and conflict among tribes. And we learn and we've discovered things like rights and contracts and trade. And, you know, I've never seen an evolutionary, a remotely plausible evolutionary explanation. Well, the reason that people like in the U.S., you know, most by and large, have property rights and respect contracts is because they were genetically conditioned to do so over the two centuries or three centuries that this culture of the modern economics has existed. That is so, it's hard even to take that an idea like that seriously. So I don't subscribe, I don't put much plausibility in evolutionary psychology, except for some, fringe things like maybe some aspects of sexual preference or some desire to have children and nurture them. I don't know. But I don't mean to say these are not important, but they're not the kinds of ethical decisions that we make and are perfectly capable of thinking through and choosing. You really have to deny free will in order to, get evolutionary psychology off the ground.
All right. Roger, I know I pulled you up on stage because I wanted you close. But if you had a question you wanted to ask, go ahead and unmute yourself. Otherwise, I was going to turn. Go ahead, Roger.
I do have a question, but I would love to go to Jason first. I always like to hear from the scholars first.
All right. Professor Hill, I know you might be en route in your travels, but if you're someplace where you'd like to unmute and...
Sure. Thank you. Thanks, Jennifer. And thank you, David. David, there's a question I wanted to ask you, piggybacking off of what Richard Toss said about Aristotle, and that is the stuff, the raw material that provided the basis for induction for the Greeks was something that was called doxa, which was opinion. It was sort of like the received wisdom that came from pretty smart people. The thing is that in a sort of homogeneous society of very smart people, that received wisdom, that doxa, was not subject to any kind of philosophical meaning test. So sort of extrapolating from that to a heterogeneous society where we have a lot of, shall I say, stupid people, deplorables, dumb people, people who think that they're sophomoric high school opinions ought to be elevated to the level of human knowledge, and that their uninformed judgments are the final conclusive, form some sort of final conclusive thought that should be taken quite seriously. How do we deal with doxa? I mean, how do we deal with that stuff that Aristotle talked about, that is the basis that opens up the Nicomachean ethics, that forms the basis out of which induction really begins today. What's your thought on that? I gave a talk on elitism. I'm a old-fashioned elitist in the sense that I do not think that the common man has some sort of coercive monopoly on truth. I'm very suspicious of the common man having some kind of, but at the same time, I don't believe that narrowly educated PhDs also have any kind of coercive monopoly on truth. I remember when I was doing my PhD, I went to someone who does Kant, and I asked him something about Kant's epistemology, and he said, "I'm sorry, you cannot ask me that question. I only focus on the third antinomy." And I said, "Are you serious?" He said, "Yes." and he said, "Ask just a basic question about one of the categories." And he said, "I only do the third antinomy. I've spent my entire 35 years working on the third antinomy." So what do you think, David?
Well, let me respond to the last point you mentioned about the third antinomy. One of the problems with, I think, a lot of analytic so-called philosophy today is precisely that people get so specialized that they lose any sight of the broader picture, and including their premises and the assumptions they're making, methodological as well as substantive. And they, you know, I've had people tell me, you know, colleagues in philosophy, reading so much stuff, they say it's breathtaking. You're flying at 30,000 feet, and I say, no, I'm just providing the broad context. Anyway, but to on Aristotle's doxa, there's a difference here. Aristotle could look around and observe Athenian society, which was at the time was a highly successful society, despite a lot of problems, and look at the what seemed to be the grounds for success, both individually and politically. But those observations are different from doxa. Doxa are opinions. And induction, we can take account of the opinions of wise people who've reflected on things before, but they're not the standard. The standard is reality. In this respect, we have years ago we published, Will Thomas and I created a series called Objectivist Studies. And one of the monographs in that series was by Roderick Long, where he precisely argues that we have to rely on doxa, not on direct. We can't do everything down to observations of reality. And I, you know, he was a smart guy and a good Aristotelian scholar. That would be interesting. It might be interesting to read if we haven't seen it already. And this is it's called Reason and Value, Aristotle versus Rand. And I'm sure that's on our website somewhere. It's certainly available. The broad picture here is very much along the lines of what I've been saying. You expand the support that observations and inductions provide, that observations provide to generalizations by expanding your evidence base and actively looking for counterexamples. So I don't know how possible this was for the Greeks, but some of them looked to Persia. Some of them, they were great traders across the Mediterranean, and there were many philosophers other than Aristotle who, you know, called into question Greek beliefs because they experienced the Levant, Israel and Palestine now, or the Black Sea civilizations, and or the Persian Empire, like Herodotus, did a lot of observing of that. He went to Egypt as well. So there were grounds, and I think Aristotle was just kind of limited in that respect, despite his genius. But today we have so much more knowledge, and again, going back to what I said about multiculturalism, the more you know about different ways people have chosen to live, and the more you can gain information and draw conclusions from their experiences, and which ones have been productive, which ones, you know, by the normal standards of wealth and prosperity, health, longevity, and so forth. You can expand these the inductive basis for your conclusions. Again, it's hard work, but it's the only way.
Right. Thanks. That's helpful, David.
Roger?
Yeah, allow me to ask a spicy question, if you will. I typically don't like doing that, but I've got David Kelly here, and I have to ask this. It's the reason why this room really caught my attention, is when I think of inductive reasoning and being able to rely on reason, and your perception to be able to determine what reality is, the first thing that comes to my mind is this. In 2022, there's a growing number of people that, whether they know it or not, they're embracing these floating abstractions. And if we were to get specific about this, just something as simple as knowing what a woman is. You have people that are denying science and saying silly things like science is racist and sexist and all of these other things, and just denying, you know, any semblance of reason. And my question would be, how do you philosophically, if you had a student in your class that was operating with these floating abstractions, how would you try to walk them through a grounding through this inductive process to figure out something as simple as what a woman is?
Well, gosh, we have some teachers in this session, and I should appeal to them for their comments because they have to deal with this every day, and I will. But I would just say, the first question I almost always ask is, what would you take as an answer? What do you mean by X, like equality or in this case, gender? What do you mean by it? Let's talk about that concept and get them to do what they should have done in forming the concept, which is to ask what they're contrasting it with, what they're in technical terms, what measurements they're omitting. And I put the burden on them to make the case that to root their what they're saying in some kind of reality. Philosophy, I think, is generally a good training on this, even, you know, on the part of, doesn't matter almost what the philosopher's own point of view is. Philosophers tend to be asked this kind of question and promote discussion. Richard, for example, said earlier that in teaching about the mixed economy, he's trying to separate out, get people to see, well, what's the mixture? There's some free enterprise initiative, voluntary trade, there's some government mandates, and how do they differ? I mean, Richard, I shouldn't put words in your mouth here or techniques in your mouth, but that's the only way I know. I wish I had a magic wand and I could just transfer intelligence, just wave a wand and have, you know, my brain or your brain, you know, communicate directly with theirs and allow them to see what we see. But you know, that's not how it works. I don't know, Debbie and I think Will, Will's still teaching economics, aren't you, Will?
Will might have a hard time unmuting. I did want to hear from Jason on this because he is teaching and he is our resident expert on critical now? Theory. Oh, yeah.
Hello, Abby.
This is Will.
Hey, Will.
Sorry, I thought the mute signal meant, never mind. Yeah, wait. David, what was your question about economics? I mean, I don't get
the
correct stuff, really.
Oh, okay.
I teach at a Catholic college. I mean, there, the Catholic college is pretty colonized by political correctness, but in economics, not so much.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, I was answering the question, how do you, as a teacher, how do you get people to get past their floating concepts that they have? Roger's question had to do specifically with the question, what is a woman, you know, in the transgender debate these days. I don't know if that comes up in economics,
I was just going to say that, no, my students don't challenge that way. Sometimes okay. I wish they would, but they don't really. And I just want to say I might have another comment about the general topic, but I'll let Roger go on.
Well, why don't you go ahead? Because we've got 4 more minutes, and I've got a hard stop because in a half an hour we're going to be interviewing James Lindsay. He's the author of Cynical Theories and Race Marxism, and actually, Roger, I'll bring your question up to him because it seems that a lot of the critical theory is aimed towards actually denying science and denying reason as concepts, valid concepts in of themselves. So, Will, if you want to just close us out.
Well, I may close with a bomb. You hear me okay?
Yeah.
My bomb is just that the virtue of rationality and objectivism is a totalistic virtue, saying, and it's connected to objectivism's atheism, for example, just one of those things. But if we observe right. people, we notice that many people compartmentalize, and people use white lies a lot, where they go to, you know, avoid difficult situations. And then there's indeed people with doctrines that, yes, well, maybe you should use some practical rationality, but you should follow your emotions to be happy in what you're doing. And anyway, that's the bomb.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Will. Those are exactly the kinds of things I was fishing for at the end of my talk and the question, the challenge I posed. There are so many questions and so many objections to rationality as a you know, total virtue that they need to be addressed. Some of them have been addressed many times, others are more new. And this is why I believe that, and they keep coming along. And this is one of the reasons that I think objectivism has to be an open philosophy. I'm going to talk about that next month, but that we need to be open to consider keep on the lookout for possible problems, possible objections. Many of them are you know, fallacious, but we don't know that until we understand them. So I think this is a great question and an invitation to continue this inquiry together or on our own. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
If I can add one final comment, that virtue is notable for being hard, and rationality turns out to be hard too.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, David, and thank you, Debbie and Will. I want to also special thanks to our senior scholars, Richard Salzman and Jason. And if you are interested in hearing my interview with James Lindsay, that's going to be happening in 30 minutes. It'll be live streamed across all of the Atlas Society's social media accounts. And please check out the events section of our site so that you can get a full rundown of our future interviews. And also, we've got some really terrific clubhouses coming up. And we'd love to have you back. So thanks, everybody.